Okay, that was wild. So we do a conflict navigation session and we put up a survey to say, name your biggest fight. And I've never seen anything like that before.
Greatest hits. Incredible.
So, never fought until you fought a man with another man's leg in his mouth.
I'm a guy. When she glared at me, loosened her bra straps, got into a wrestling stance, and stated, I have brothers. I knew I was in trouble. We're now married.
I can't find it in these. Oh, yeah, it was. It was the phrase, the bear won, except we're in a part of the country where that's actually a real thing. It's not a metaphor.
Yeah. There was another one that I really like. Oh, it just said, welcome to the Wild West. That was the singular response.
So the other piece that I love is that geography matters. Yeah. Is that things, I'm from Libby. I once slammed a bully's face into a bar table.
And everybody in the room knew what that meant.
Oh, yeah, no, that's totally right.
Yeah.
And then can I just say, the one that I said earlier, I'm just scrolling through this trying to find it, but the one that was about the, I had the guy's leg in my mouth, right above it was, the other answer to your biggest fight was, my spouse turned vegan. So he literally had cannibalism and veganism as a cause of a fight.
Welcome to the Wild West.
We are out west. This is Envoy Recorded Radio. So locations, well, it's pretty obvious we're in the west, but where are we?
We are in, according to my flight attendant on the way in, Helena.
Yeah, except all the locals are like, it's not Helena, that's where you sent Napoleon. It's Helena. We are in the capital of Montana. And can I just say, I'm going to be on a 5:30 a.m. flight tomorrow from the airport. And this is my favorite airport in the country.
It's adorable. Not for the reason you would think.
It has four gates, only which two have used. The same old lady who checks you in is also like the TSA security clerk and boards your flight. But for the cafe, because of course there isn't a cafe.
Yeah.
They put out a little pot of coffee and some donuts and you just help yourself and there's no
it's
charge.
Like a little continental breakfast.
Yeah, there's no fee. It's just, hey, the people of Montana wish you well, travel well. So yeah,
just good people.
All right, involuntary sponsor of the week.
Yeah, first off, I guess the state of Montana. Did I write that?
Well, we wrote it for different reasons. You explain your reason.
No, you go first.
All right. So my reason is that the lieutenant governor of the state of Montana has become the highest ranking officer ever to play carrot in the box. And for those of you who do not know, carrot in a box is a spoof bluffing game where you fake whether you have a carrot in your box or the carrot is in somebody else's box.
You don't get to describe exercises anymore.
Yeah.
What happens is there are two boxes. One person has a carrot in their box. One person does not. Only one person gets to look into the box. And the person who gets to look into their box, the goal is to end up with the carrot at the end of the game. And so the person who looks in their box either knows they have a carrot or knows they don't and has to bluff their way into either keeping the carrot or getting the person to swap their box with them. The person who hasn't looked at their box gets one decision to make, whether they keep their box or swap the box with the other person. And so it's a game of bluff. It's brilliant.
So it is a game that Jimmy Carr, the comedian back in the UK, plays. And I think it's very funny. But to the credit of the lieutenant governor of Montana, she introduced this session. And unexpectedly, because she was a great sport, we decided we would play carrot in the box to kick off this session. And also, I'm the worst briefer of exercises ever. And so I think I broadly said, Lieutenant Governor, tell a story about a carrot.
Which, to her credit, she did. Fully told the story.
Everybody laughed and it was great. So not only did the Lieutenant Governor of Montana play Carrot in the Box. I'm not even sure she did play it because I briefed the game so terribly. She just told a story about a carrot, but it was great. So
It was great. yeah, so my State of Montana involuntary sponsor of the week is just that this place is gorgeous. It is incredible. So we finished up dinner this evening. We divided and conquered for dinner. So Vera, Perry, and I had some time after dinner, and we got into the car, and I said, Perry, pick a direction. And he said left, and so we drove. And we ended up with some beautiful views, but yeah, we just got out into... We saw the deer here look kind of like donkeys. And I don't know how to describe that other than the deer here kind of look like donkeys. It's unsettling. But yeah, it's, I would love to come back and like, we're here to work.
There was this moment we were driving through town yesterday and Janet Kelly on our team, who is the former secretary of the Commonwealth of the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, yelled, "There's donkey deer."
She did yell
and
that.
To be fair, it was an accurate description of what she was seeing out the window.
Believe her at first, and then there was another couple of them. I was like, holy shit, they do look like donkeys. Yeah. All right. So that's a second quick involuntary sponsor of the week is Carrie Devant, who's the executive director of human resources for the Montana University System, so works for the Commissioner for Higher Education. And beyond just being a brilliant human, Carrie has already started seeding some fodder because, bless your heart, Carrie, tuning into ERR regularly and continuing to do so, and then coming to a training, having heard these two Muppets doing ERR, means a lot to us. We love that you tuned in. And more importantly, really, really excited to just have some back channeling of, hey, you should have said this different. And here's a good thing for you to talk about next episode. So, Carrie, welcome.
All right, onto the zeitgeist. So I'm going to stay sort of linking to the theme of Montana is the theme of horses, but we're going to jump to London. And this is wild. So if you're in London a couple of days ago, there is a very good chance that you were walking down the street and you saw seven wild horses loose galloping through the streets of London, because on an exercise, the army, apparently what happened is, so there's various very small barracks in London for mm-hmm. like the honorary guards. And as you know, if you're a tourist in London, you see the army that's patrolling outside of Buckingham Palace. And I think a lot of people think that those guards, like, that's a full-time job. It's not. They're genuine soldiers who are on rotation, yeah. And you do like a 6-week thing and then you move back into regular army life, but you're in full uniform for those purposes. But the horses, there was a construction activity happening next door, mm-hmm. There was builders next door, and they dropped a heavy load and it made a loud bang, and seven of these horses
just
bolted.
Took off.
So this imagery of these horses running wild through the streets of London, but they went a long way. Like two of them made it from Westminster to basically Shoreditch, you hang out, which is right across the city. So you're like, thousands of people saw wild horses running through London. And listen, the horses seem to be doing okay. There was one that was heavily bloodied. The army is issuing very passionate press releases about the state of health of these horses. But it is a reminder that cavalry charges really hurt, because the damage is that these horses have run into double-decker buses, and these buses are like written off.
Dented.
Like,
yeah. I saw like footage of one, and the horse was running down the street, and then it realized there was kind of a dead end, or it was coming to a T. So it's like, shit, I need to turn. So it starts to take a left, but there's one of the black cabs And it kind of jumps and all four hooves hit the cab and it kicks off. It like parkoured off of the cab.
Parkour cabbie.
I hope. You remember the cabbie I talked to about loneliness?
Yeah.
I hope it was Paul's cab. No, I don't hope it was Paul's cab. I just hope that like my man Paul got to see the horses in London.
That so I got, we're obviously out of town. I got to text my youngest today, who's her British passport came through. I got a text from the His Majesty's passport office saying her passport was approved. And so I got to text her and say, okay, you're officially British now. And by the way, we have horses that run through the capital city. And, you know, Dylan's really passionate about horses. She's like, this is the coolest thing in the world. Like, I'm into this. All right. Actually, while we stay in the UK, let's do a little bit of Brit news and then we'll move on. So the British government have got through both houses, so the House of Commons and the House of Lords, legislation that means that if you are 15 or younger in the UK, you will never be able to legally smoke. So it is this iterating age. So you know that you have to be, how old do you have to be to buy cigarettes in the US? State by state, 18. Right? 18.
I think.
So, quote me on that. I think it's 18 in the UK, it might be 21, but from this point forward, that age will increase by a year every year. So like if you're 15 now,
oh
yeah, you'll never catch up with the age. It automatically increases. So in a few years, the age that you can buy cigarettes will be 27. And in 20 years, it will be the age that you can buy cigarettes is 47. So if you're 15 today in the UK, you will never, ever be able to be of legal age to buy cigarettes.
So the ability to legally buy cigarettes will just die out with the generation.
Yeah. Now, of course, you can buy it illegally and all of those things, sure. But it's an interesting. So New Zealand was actually the first country to introduce this legislation a few years ago, but then a new government came in and withdrew it. And for whatever reason, I'm not quite sure the reason, the UK Conservative government they've managed to get it through. It's really interesting to see whether it will hold, and then whether it's effective or whether it'll generate. There's a lot of pushback against it. Is it will be the new prohibition? But yeah, if you are 16, you are the last generation in the UK in principle who will ever smoke legally.
That's crazy.
Isn't it? Yeah, I know. It's strange. Yeah.
Good for them. Which, interestingly enough, culturally, it feels like smoking is more, has proliferated British culture more than it has. Like, being in London, you see people smoking a little more, or perhaps a little differently, or a little more publicly than I feel like we do Americans. That may just be my perception. Do you feel that?
Yeah, actually, I know what you mean by that. There's a little bit of a screw you, I'm smoking.
Yeah.
Whereas you're much more likely. So if you look at the rates, the smoking rate between the two countries is pretty similar, but you sort of see Americans smoking
a little more discreetly, or at least secluded.
They're kind of like behind the Walmart.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a, like,
yeah.
You're just, whereas it's almost, there's so much of a social stigma about smoking that it's kind of like, screw you, I'm smoking.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is different. It's interesting you notice that.
Yeah. can we talk about Alexis Ohanian?
We could if I had any clue who they were.
Alexis Ohanian is Serena Williams' husband.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, Serena Williams' husband is investing in the Sports Bra, which is apparently an iconic bar in Portland, Oregon.
Wait. It's a bar. It's not actually a sports bra.
Correct.
It's a bar named the Sports Bra.
Yeah. It's a Portland destination called the Sports Bra. And actually, the article only says Portland, and I have not been to the Sports Bra, so it might be Portland, Maine, but it's probably Portland, Oregon, if I had to guess. So he's the husband of Serena Williams.
The tell is the link you put in is the publication is Oregon Live. I'm pretty confident it's Portland, Oregon.
No, I'm not sure.
But hey, it might be about Portland, Maine.
Cannot confirm. Yeah. Oh, it is Oregon Live. Here, right. I'm an idiot. So yeah, he's got a foundation called the 776 Foundation, and all of the returns from the investment. So he's helping this like iconic bar franchise, or he's investing. He's not helping the women running this bar. Jenny Nguyen, the owner of Sports Bra, is building this thing out and taking it to other cities where it might thrive. And but all what's of special the returns about it? Are going to be invested back into girls and women's sports.
Okay, so the profits go to women's sports.
Yeah, all right, via Ohanian's foundation.
Yeah.
So, of course, it's his wife, Serena, a phenomenal, iconic tennis legend. And, of course, they have a daughter now who I would imagine would just be a stud because, you know, they're both incredible athletes. And, yeah, I think it'll be pretty cool. So the thing is, I talk about Alexis Ohanian as Serena Williams' husband, which is A, true, B, the thing he is best known for, and C, hilarious. But Alexis Ohanian's a UVA grad. You probably hold that against him. co-founded Reddit with Steve Huffman. So he's the Reddit co-founder, started at UVA. And
yeah, but I love this.
Yeah.
I think this is great. Because there's no shortage of women who are known as the wife of, but in their own field are absolutely top of their game. But because their husband is a top politician or a top celebrity, I love the fact that this guy has actually built stuff, is a thing, but is not Serena Williams and therefore is known as Serena Williams' husband.
Yeah. But this is a segue from that topic to a second one, which is our propensity to accost people in public.
What?
So there's a theme. So I was in Tampa. Yeah. I was in Tampa this week. Got to give a talk at Kobe Marketing's On Point conference about loyalty and DEI and how DEI is dead and what we do with that. And it was like really fun and provocative and I had a blast. But the president of Kobe happens to be a dear friend of mine and she got up and gave the background story of how we met, which is I had seen her speak at a conference and then I saw her in an alley in Richmond, Virginia at night, like a month later. And I pitched her on my business, but didn't consider that I am a large man in a dark alley in a sketchy part of Richmond who is coming up to this woman who is walking to her car and saying, "Hey, you're Marty, right?" And she engaged and we have been friends for
Did she agree to invest in your business while also handing over her purse and wallet?
I'm not sure if she was investing or just handing over her purse and wallet, but you know, it doesn't matter. Interestingly enough,
not investing does not equal that she handed you her purse and you went through it and there was a few dollars.
She gave me money. That's all I'm saying. Okay. Not a non sequitur. I ran into Alexis Ohanian in New York. I had just gotten in on a flight. This was in the same era of building startups. I had just gotten in on a flight. I was down in FIDI doing something. Apparently, Alexis was down with his videographer doing some filming. And I saw him. I clocked him. I sprinted up the block on the other side of the block he was walking on, cut across, and happened to run into him. Introduced myself, and to his credit, I started talking about the company I was building, and he was kind enough to ask what I was up to and bought me coffee, and we sat for 20-25 minutes, and he let me tell him about my business and kind of poked holes, and like it was just this brilliant thing, and fortune favors the bold is, I think, as I look back on a theme of finding connections just by hawking people down. And all I'll say is, in my defense, you do it too. So
I did it this week.
Did you really?
What is the name of just like hitting people up? What is the name of the CNN doctor? Gupta.
Dr. Sanjay.
Sanjay Gupta. So we're on our way out here to Montana.
Yeah.
And we're in the lounge thing at the airport.
This is while I was in
Tampa. Yeah, you're in Tampa. Okay. So we're there and I clock this guy walk in. And so I want to talk about the social isolation thing that we're working on. But so I'm aware of healthcare stuff, right? And healthcare influences. And because the last time I did this was Chuck Schumer and I had to duck his, his security.
I
almost got shot on that one. But so I see this guy walks in. And I was like, that guy looks a bit like the doctor from CNN and he's got this show. And so I said to Vera and Janet, I was like, I think that might be Sanjay Gupta, but I don't think he, like, he doesn't seem the right height. And so as we're walking out, Janet says, yeah, you know, but people look much taller on TV than they actually are. And so we're heading to the elevator as we go in, and Vera being Vera, right? We get in the elevator. We're in the elevator, and there's like 7 or 8 people in this elevator heading down. And they're all like those road warrior types, like very, very self-important. And Vera goes, 5'8". She like clocked it.
Please tell me, like, you stopped the elevator.
No, I gunned out of the elevator. I left my bag. And Janet is like, you can see on the face, like, and Vera's like, oh, this is standard operating procedure. And then I went up to Sanjay and I was like, listen, we're working
first,
on this.
First name basis now.
Yeah, we're besties. Yeah. No, really not. So what I do think is, if you are going to pitch somebody, it's really important for you to be like, first of all, thank you and sorry, this is going to be really quick. Here's my card. And I'm not going to ask you your contact details, but I will follow up with your office. There's my top tip. Because this happens to us sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to pitch somebody, nail a concept, hand over your business card, and also don't put the burden on them to pass on your card to somebody else.
Yep.
Like, call our office and say, we had that conversation, which of course V went off to do. Actually, Chuck Schumer was interesting, because we were working on this thing, still are working on this thing about... I shouldn't talk about it too much, but it has big ramifications about the security of a lot of people overseas. And what Senator Schumer did was, you can tell, like, they're pros at this thing. I gave him my card. He wrote down the number of the person on his staff that was helpful and gave me the card back and signed it and said, send a photograph of this card to them, which I thought was a very smart way of handling the ask, which is, I've pre-filtered the idea. I think there's some effort to it, but you're going to have to prove to my staff that you have the thing.
Yeah.
And then, do you know what I did? I posted it to our chat room, and then Jamie went, oh yeah, I know this guy. I'll just give him a call. I was like, well, that whole thing was a bloody waste of time, wasn't it? I almost got shot for no reason.
Almost didn't good enough, Scott.
Yeah. As always, being out battered by our own team. Well, what's this, like, Google Boss Go Faster? What's the whole Go Faster thing?
Yeah, so, I mean, kind of self-explanatory, Scott. Google Boss says go faster. The head of Google Search, so Prabhakar Rajivan, basically said to his employees what we are seeing across leadership in just about every industry right now, which is there's going to continue to be a market shift. Things are not like they were 15 to 20 years ago. Not adapting or not changing is an option, but the ramifications of not changing will be death of our organization or your professional world as you know it. And that sounds heavy-handed, but innovate or die, I think, is rearing its ugly but predictable head of late. And so basically, at an all-hands meeting, Rajivan said user behavior is changing, competition's heating up, the regulatory environment is becoming a bigger challenge to navigate, and he's giving his people a shorter amount of time to work on certain projects. So he's just pushing the pace on the work that has to be done, how quickly it needs to get shipped. And the operating reality is changing for all of us, particularly for search, of course, as AI and different platforms are continuing to shift. But Google Boss says, hurry the fuck up. We don't have time to drag feet.
It's interesting that they've actually had a great few years and they're growing aggressively. They're over the last 3 years, that I think this is quite telling about the pressure.
Yeah.
On organizations right now. He noted that over the last 3 years, annual revenue has grown by more than $100 billion. So that exceeds Starbucks' annual revenue. Mm-hmm. So they've grown by more than Starbucks' annual revenue. Oh, sorry. Starbucks, Mazda, and TikTok combined. That's an interesting combination of companies to like pick to hit exactly that number.
A reporter needs to hit a number and they pick three companies. Like,
they probably had Microsoft AI which is what Google's worried about. But he's saying they still need to be faster still.
Yeah. Yep.
you know what these guys need? A little dose of the old lady at Helena Airport who just puts out the coffee and says, go for your life. No, it's kind of interesting though, isn't it? Like, I mean this on a quite serious basis of the quality of life of these, let's say you're a middle executive at one of these Silicon Valley companies and you are like immersed in this world and you live in Palo Alto or you live in, I forget, like some of the neighborhoods in Seattle, where these clusters of execs live, and you're making great money, but also the cost of life is really high because everything from childcare to transportation to cleaners to for your fancy house is like crazy expensive, and comparing it to bluntly the little old lady at Helena Airport who. Yeah, the income will be a fraction, but her freedom and her time, and also you kind of step outside and you have these beautiful mountains and this clean air and as many conspiracy theorists as you can ever find, it is interesting around this. We haven't actually nailed the language around success being quality of life. We are still talking about speed, money, these kind of things.
All things that track to GDP. And Janet on stage today in Helena put some words to a metric we've started tracking, not Envoy, but society, of gross domestic happiness. And, you know, what's the output of humans enjoying themselves? I there's a world in which I would move back to New York City. I would think about it. But
let's be honest, you think about it every single day.
No, and like credit or something to you. I consider London sometimes as well.
Everybody just listen to that bit.
You know, delete Perry, delete this part when you go through the edit. But I promised myself when I left New York, I was like, I won't go back unless I'm making a certain amount of money. And that dollar amount has even changed. But it would be to exist in New York without having to. I mean, you got to work 18-hour days in a lot of respects to exist in that place comfortably. And most of the people who do that work so hard that when they have time to enjoy themselves, they get the heck out of New York City. And like, in order to be in that, basically, I'm open to anybody who has opinions on how to get a trust fund. I think that would be the way to like legitimately go enjoy New York and not have to grind through your eyeballs to be there and not enjoy being there because you don't have time to carve out to enjoy it. And like, what's the point?
So I'm going to make the hypothesis that it's almost impossible to enjoy New York today. Today.
Yeah.
Today. Not in the past. In London, one could argue is very close to that. Is that, to work there and make ends meet is a difficult transaction. But also the trust fund thing, I was married in my 20s to an amazing woman who had a trust fund. It wasn't enormous, but it was sufficient. It was more money than I'd ever imagined that I'd have. This is not beginning on record as saying I have sympathy for those who have wealth, but it does take away that rationale for meeting people and engaging people. And the joy of cities like a New York or a London is that you're actually working on stuff. Mm-hmm. So you almost have to work to enjoy it. You can't be there as a passenger. I say this a lot about, like I've talked about this before, is I don't believe in bucket lists in terms of seeing things or going places. I believe in bucket lists in terms of experiences. There is a huge, one of my favorite cities in the whole world is Istanbul. Istanbul is crazy. It's nuts. It's this intersection of two continents, different religions. The Turks are great. There's this hospitality and the food is awesome. The wine is good. But there's a huge difference between going there as a tourist and just like living on the surface versus having stuff to do there. You are doing business with Turkish Airlines or you're dealing with the government or you're hosting a summit there because it makes you live through it, which is it's so much better than living on the froth. If you're just living in New York because, or any of these sort of big cities, because you can afford to, but you don't have any purpose there, I'm not. You're on the flotsam. You're not actually in the. I don't know what the opposite of flotsam is.
Somebody I just know that jetsam's attached to it. I don't jetsam know what jetsam is either.
Yeah, it's one of those. We should. Do you know when I was heading for the words flotsam, I knew it was a stretch.
Yeah, you should know. I love that you commit to the bit,
Perry. If I didn't get that right, just take that out.
Leave it. Okay. So we have a decision to make because I see digital sex slavery and I also see TikTok.
So maybe we talk about them both because I actually think they're a little bit related. Are they related? Maybe you talk about TikTok and then I'll talk about digital sex slavery.
Basically, Congress finally got to the place where they banned TikTok unless ByteDance sells its owner. And President Biden signed the bill.
So this was all tied to the Ukraine deal. Maybe, I mean, this bridges with Envoy Tank Radio, but Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, took a real risk. And there's some fascinating articles in Politico and the Washington Post about the backstory to this. But Mike Johnson was very against aid for Ukraine. And apparently under private briefings from Burns, the head of the CIA, and various members of the NSC, he recognized that there is much more at stake for U.S. and Western interests than short-term politics. He took the risk to try to get the vote through the House for the Ukraine funding, which was also included funding for exports of weapons for Israel, but also banning, essentially telling ByteDance they have to sell TikTok or they'll be closed down in the U.S. So it was a really interesting sort of package deal. He is taking a lot of heat for it. And I think it's important for people like me when I don't align with the political outlook of a particular individual, when they do something brave like that, to say that was a real act of bravery and he will pay the political heat for it. And I hope history serves him well for that issue. But the TikTok thing is really fascinating. Yeah, I mean, this is the US government has decided that the mere existence of this thing, and we've talked about this before, the TikTok in China is very different from the TikTok in the US, is a threat to the United States and it needs to be sold. Mm-hmm. And they followed it through. So yeah, ByteDance, they either sell it or it will be closed down in, what's the timeline? A month?
A year.
It was a year.
It's a year. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Okay. And somehow digital.
No. So this, it's unrelated, but kind of related, which is the digital experience. You probably like me, because your profile is out on the web. You probably, I don't know how many women receive these, but I probably get 3 text messages a day.
Oh yeah.
And it's starting to appear on LinkedIn now. Yeah. The bait is typically like, oh, hey, I'm sorry I missed your call, or how are you doing today? It was great to see you again. And it's a dangle for men who are back to the loneliness thing we're talking about, who are lonely, and then they engage with somebody who is presenting themselves as a woman, and you're gradually sort of like catfished into this environment where you end up sending money. And one imagines that there is an algorithm or a bot or if it's a human, a woman at the end. And as a result of various investigations, one of them by the New York Times, it's not, it's men. What is going on? This is the slave enslavement of men in East Asia, who are enticed with slightly higher paying laboring jobs, and they are then entrapped and taken into rural areas of places like Myanmar and Cambodia, and end up in these digital camps where they are just churning out catfishing messages and are physically imprisoned in these environments. Now, I want to be clear, there is also an exploitation of women in this environment, but the industrialization of this machine essentially looks like, why would you waste men on sending the text messages? Because it has to be customized, right? You're doing this sort of nurturing and grooming. And then the women who are in this environment are then having photographs, not necessarily deeply explicit photos, but customized photos.
Yeah.
So if you're that lonely person sitting here in Montana, you text and you say, oh, send me a picture of you, but wear a red shirt. And then these poor women wear a red shirt and they send it through. But we are talking about transmissions of billions of dollars in terms of this digital crime running through this. And we tend to think of this in a certain space, but it is the very same people who 150 years ago would have been working the Intercontinental Railroad in the United States and are now being exploited in this space. And I'm not sure what the title of TikTok is, but I think it's in the same world. It's this lower cost economy that is feeding off a higher wealth economy. It's hard to identify. There are victims on both sides. There's the intermediary that's making the difference. And it's a thing, and kind of look into it. And so when you see these campaigns against the anti-slavery movement, and you may notice increasingly, it is not just images of women, it's images of men as well. We are living in a world of, as we are separating these wealth demographics, of digital enslavement as much as we might have imagined it 30, 40, 50 years ago, of working on cocoa plantations in West Africa, mm-hmm. or in different environments in different places. We've talked about sort of Filipinos working in Hong Kong, and this is sort of the next iteration of it. And it's real, and it continues. Anyway, don't reply to those text messages.
Can I like keep the two or three relationships that I've built already?
So you should just know that's me.
Shit.
Also, stop sending those photos.
Yeah.
Well. It's not. Well, to be fair, the photos you send to those, they're not explicit. It's just a little socially awkward.
Just wanted you to know what I had for dinner. That's all. What's next? Let's go to Tank Radio.
All right. We've talked about Mike Johnson already. Yeah. Just two things for this. One is the language of war. The United Kingdom has joined Poland and another couple of countries in committing that defense spending is going to go up as high as 2.5% of GDP, which you're talking about, in this case, an increase in defense spending of around 175 billion pounds, so about 100 billion US dollars. I mean, really significant increases in defense spending in an environment where budgets are very tight. But I think what is most interesting or worrying about this is that it is using the language of preparing for war, and that this has become normalized now. Mm-hmm. And the Poles led the way on this. And I get it. Poland's history with Russia and Germany is such that when Russia invaded Ukraine, Poland moved to this. We are preparing for war. We are buying these assets. We are doing these things. But it is now with Macron in France and now Sunak in the UK we are using the language of preparing for war should it come. Now, there's always that disclaimer, and I'm glad there's that disclaimer. But this language has seeped in, which feels very 1939-ish. And even to the extent that it is, the language is, we cannot bank on the Americans being part of it. And it's very nuanced language because it's encouraging the Americans, but also being, we can't quite bank that depending on the administration that the US will be involved. And so just that slow ramping up as it goes through, and then just wild stuff. And again, we talk about Ukraine a lot, but then, I mean, we've talked about World War One and trench warfare, balloon bombing. So you remember everybody was very uptight about the Chinese spy balloon that was floating over the United States, which I love this story because the U.S. military didn't disguise the fact that China does this all the time and the U.S. does this to China all the time. It was just the first time some American looked up and noticed it. They're like, they weren't just buying shit in a mall and looked up and went, oh, there's a big balloon there. But yeah, so the Ukrainians, back in World War One, Germany and Britain and France would put up balloons and hope that the wind pointed in the right direction and that they would explode. What the Ukrainians are doing is putting very sophisticated GPS navigation guidance on it, loading up essentially the basket with explosives and using a combination of wind power and propellers to use these things. And there's very little that Russia can do to intercept them because they're such low profile. And you may remember that Chinese spy balloon, the F-22 Raptor, the most sophisticated jet in the world, had real trouble. They ended up sending an F-16 up because the F-22 couldn't get high enough to get to it. Like using these technologies that are new old to bypass this is, it's crackers. And I think this might end up in the private sector. I think we're seeing this dichotomy by the super sophisticated technology mm-hmm. and then the opposite. And where people, so you've either got this like highly integrated, state-of-the-art, fully automated, computerized, and then you've got this other market for get the hell off the grid, get into the woods, do something different. And we're seeing this in military affairs too.
It's wild. And you know, I would imagine if I were hearing us describe, I would be thinking about a hot air balloon with munitions tied to it. And it's like, you know, the picturesque, like go up in a hot air balloon with a basket and like have a picnic in the air or something. Like yeah. very romantic. Yeah, it's not that. Like this, for one, the picture I have in front of me, I can't imagine you watched Rick and Morty. Yeah, but, I got no but idea what if anybody about. Watched Rick and Morty, it looks like Pickle Rick. It's just like that's what it looks like, a long like pickle or cucumber with an eyeball at the top and then some things dangling from it. And so it's basically like imagine
it's a flying pickle.
It looks like a large size like pickle or like one of the long balloons that you see at a carnival.
Yeah.
It looks like one of
uninflated.
Those. Yeah. And it's literally got a controller. So like for controlling the munition attached to it. For some, there's a like a water bottle attached to it. Often, I would imagine for ballast or for weight rather, and then a tracker. And like think about these things literally just daisy chained to a balloon. So you've got a big balloon that like could heft some weight, and you just tie a couple things to it. Some of those things explode. Some of those things tell you where the thing is before it explodes. And like, that's what they are sending into the air. And so when I say, when Scott says lack of sophistication, I think we're talking 3D printed bits and bobs and a couple pieces of pseudo expensive technology, but well less than what one would expect to spend on a piece of munition. And they're sending them. And some crash. But there's this disposable element to them. Some hit their target, and like that's great. But the rules of engagement, not rules of engagement legally, but the rules of war are shifting a little bit, and how we're maybe devolving on the technology front rather than evolving, but devolving in order to fit the battlefield or the shifting in environment. It's fascinating to watch.
So there's a structure to think about this that I think, so when we joke about Envoy Tank Radio, we've always talked about like trying to bridge the gap between civilian and military, because there is such a gap between civilian and military. But there's a structure this, if when you live in the civilian world, you see all of these toys and techniques and new things. But in the military or the intelligence sense, they all have tags. So you talk about platforms, sensors, and then often the phrase is sort of kinetic engagement. Kinetic is sort of like a polite way of saying stuff that blows up. So a platform is anything that can carry something else. Yeah. So a satellite doesn't have a purpose. It's a platform on which you can put sensors. Mm-hmm. A ship or a submarine aren't ships or submarines, there are platforms, and what you put on them determines what they are. And in this case, the Ukrainians have said the platform is a balloon, a pickle-shaped balloon. And on it, we're going to put a sensor, which is the tracking device, and a kinetic engagement vehicle, which is the explosive, but it's not sophisticated. But the structure is actually just the same as a state-of-the-art destroyer for a Navy.
There's a thing that can get X thing to Y place, and we decide what X thing is, and we decide what Y place is, and we figure out how
and
to get
it. And you go
there. Do it. Yeah.
And it's back to this, I was chatting tonight about, there's very little that's new. That's not true. There's lots of things that are new, but structurally there's very little that's new. And this is kind of an example of it. Platforms, sensors, and kinetic engagement or munition might be another way to put it. But
carnival balloons.
But I do think if you want to think about this, you've got to decide whether you're using British English or American English, because you can either be you can be attacked by a pickle or attacked by a gherkin, and it's the same thing, but I'd go for the gherkin balloon personally.
I have nothing.
You got nothing. You literally got nothing. Yeah. Crushed you. All right, tools for tools.
Hey, so I don't know if this is a tool or not. This is more of a question. You said a thing today that I immediately wrote down, like it connected, and the quote. Maybe you will take credit for this. I won't fully attribute. Doing the right thing based upon the data won't necessarily bring the result they want. And I believe you were talking about some audiences or leaders that you spend time with who are trying to make data-driven decisions, but haven't perhaps factored in the human element to that decision. And I'm wondering if you might speak to that. I have a couple things like that I'm jamming on right now that come to mind. But was that you?
Yeah, it was. Okay. I did say that. And it's a little bit of my confessional, which is, you know, you and me and the team teach these tools of tradecraft and stagecraft, which they're like firearms. They can be used for offensive or defensive reasons. The tool itself isn't good or bad, but it can be used for good or bad reasons. Probably used more for bad than used for good if you measured it around the world. And but the big thing you have to embrace is that the reason they exist is because they overwhelm the scientifically or objectively right answer.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking. You have to have these conversations with scientists, auditors, engineers, to say, look, in the models that you've built that are objectively brilliant, if there's another party that has a less good solution, measured objectively is less good, but they can deploy these tools to take advantage of the vulnerability of the human mind, you will lose. And so you have to learn them. Yeah. Part of your job as an objective person is to understand the vulnerability of the human mind to be swayed from those things. And I find that tradecraft fascinating, as you do.
Yeah.
But it's not a pretty message to land. And we've only just started saying it because we used to kind of say, these are like addendums to you doing the right thing and it will accentuate and accelerate. But the bottom line is you'll lose if you don't do them.
So you saw me get to play. You probably, outside of driving the truck, saw one of the biggest shit-eating grins on my face when I was surrounded by academic papers and I had a highlighter and I was sitting out at the table outside of the studio. I was digging through a project and doing some client work, and I was reading a bunch of literature from scientists and surgeons in the healthcare world. And I won't go into the science, but one thing that struck me is that basically the group of researchers who were looking at a phenomenon and some like testing and tracking basically came to the conclusion that if we stop the tracking, it won't have adverse effects on the thing that we're tracking. So people are not doing a specific behavior because it's being tracked. They're doing a behavior and they're being successful and getting to the outcomes. And we happen to be tracking it. And so there was great debate on whether they should stop the tracking or not. And basically they said the outcomes wouldn't shift if we stopped the tracking. And what I loved, the important part here, because there's great debate about the research for the body that makes decisions around the tracking and et cetera. What the researchers put in their paper explicitly was, just because the data doesn't bear out the thing that people are concerned about doesn't mean we shouldn't do the thing anyway, because humans are involved. Like, they went there and they put words to the, not tracking won't stop or start people's behavior, but the perception of tracking or not tracking may nudge people toward doing the thing we want or convince them not to do the thing we don't want. And so it was
like, this stuff is wild.
It was great, but I love that they owned it.
Around very like mathematical things, a few years ago, Kelly and I were working on a project that was about microfinance, and it was whether there was an Australian group who are experts in essentially risk credit rating of whether you should lend to like lower economic demographics. And it was all about immigrants who were coming into the country and microfinance and how do you credit profile people who don't have a credit history. And these guys came in a very Australian fashion. I'm not going to name the organization, but I laughed so hard. They were like, hey, listen, your process is so bureaucratic. Like, to get a loan. Yeah. To get a loan, you have to fill out so much paperwork. Anybody who gets to the end of this trail, you should lend money to. And I was like, hang on. What's the mathematical formula or the risk profile or econometrics behind it? And they went, no. If you've got the tenacity to put up with all this bullshit, you should lend them money. And I thought that was brilliant. And these were very quant people, but they were like, look, there is this relationship between quant and qualitative, and people who are willing to go through these steps and provide this validation and do this work is a barrier sufficient that is the same of analyzing past behavior. And I think there's a big gap in the social sciences in being able to take positions on qualitative stuff that doesn't quite fit neatly into a spreadsheet.
Yeah. It feels like that is a risk. And then there's the pseudoscience that kind of floats around that I think does the real work a disservice. And so it's hard to parse which is which. Is this just some BS made up?
Kind of like pop psychology stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Versus the like, hey, the data suggests this thing, but humans will act that way. And I mean, it's where the field of behavioral economics and behavioral science really, I think, came to bear. But that field is what, 30 years old?
Yeah.
I mean, it's relatively new. And so you would have loved this sitting at the conference I was at in Tampa. It was just like PhDs and marketers who go and data nerds talking about how humans actually make this. Like it's so much fun. But that's actually what we're saying. The data suggests this for logical, rational humans, and humans aren't logical or rational. And if we were, we would make X decision. How do we factor in that humans are stupid?
No, it's sometimes interesting that you said nerds were studying human decisions, though, because the more creative, emotional humans when studying human decision-making make the case for more rationality than there are. When robots study human decision-making, they just go, oh, they're irrational.
Mm-hmm.
And we just are. And the sooner we embrace it, and then we stop pretending that there are these sophisticated models that lead to objectivity, we'll probably be in a more comfortable place, because there'll be less dissonance. And maybe that bridges to sort of the last tool for tool, which they're kind of lame tools because we're just bantering on this section. But Dan Dennett, the philosopher, passed away this week. And he is the author of one of my favorite quotes ever, which is, the secret of happiness, find something more important than you are and dedicate your life to it. I just love that. Because he was actually an atheist philosopher, but this would apply to faith. This would apply to volunteerism. This would apply to being just a complete nerd. Is the secret of happiness, find something more important than you are and dedicate your life to it, and it won't be about you anymore.
Mm.
So mine mate is sending you sketchy text messages pretending I'm a really attractive woman in Southeast Asia.
Interestingly enough, that leads into my quote, which is from Charles Bukowski, which is, my dear, find what you love and let it kill you.
Find what you love and let it kill you?
Yep. Let it drain you of your all. Let it cling onto your back and weigh you down into eventual nothingness. Let it kill you. Let it devour your remains. For all things will kill you, both slowly and fastly. But it's much better to be killed by a lover. And apparently my lover is Scott Wayne. Text message.
Horrible message. I want to change subject to yelling at clouds. So there is a product that I hadn't heard of up until last week. And then I mentioned it to my kids. And I'm like, Dad, you're an idiot that you don't know this exists. Uncrustables. And they said, not only is it ridiculous you don't know it, Uncle Ace almost always has one of these stuffed in his mouth every time we see him. So just to be clear, a Smucker's Uncrustable is a peanut butter and jelly sandwich frozen that you idiots pay a premium for to take bread and peanut butter and jam that you could have just made yourself and shoved in the freezer, but you go to the store and you buy this stuff and then you eat it frozen. Is that what this is, an Uncrustable? It is, isn't it?
Have you had one?
No.
Well, then shut up. You love them, don't you? Yeah, they're great. They're great. I mean, look, sometimes you just got their money and stuff. You're right. You're right and also wrong. And the problem is you're so right that you can't understand why you're wrong because you haven't had an Uncrustable.
But I think this goes back to like just embracing the irrationality of people. So Smucker's here we'd call it a jelly company. In the UK, it'd be a jam company. Like they make jelly.
I don't know
they make
the differences, jam. But yeah.
And then they were looking for diversification. They'd failed on all sorts of adjacent logical products like and the better jam or whatever it is. And then they acquired this company for next to nothing relative to the revenue today that froze peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and cut the crusts off and called them Uncrustables.
Appropriately. To their credit. You like pull them out and let them thaw, but like you eat them. I eat them like a tiny bit cold.
So they're like, yeah.
They are portable peanut butter and jellies in a bag and the crust is cut off. Sure. Yeah. They're tasty. They're convenient. They're portable. And you know.
So you know those Instagram accounts that make you laugh a lot, which is British people talking about povos, poor people, and for whatever reason you just think this is really funny.
It's hilarious.
Then I've thought about like you just take the leftovers from this production line and you call them crusty's povos, and it's just the crust. Sorry, you're gonna check that. Crusty'sforpovos.com.
I'm in.
Yeah. All right. Bring this to a close. So where are we for the next week or so? Where are you next week?
I wrote here on the list that I have no idea. And then I put in parentheses as usual. I think
you
I'm
actually
home.
Don't know where
I
you are.
I have no.
I've got a strong feeling you're not, but
not home.
Yeah. I think when you come into the studio on Monday morning and you look at your calendar, and you go, actually, I should just drive to the airport right now.
I should be on a flight.
Yeah.
I should. I'm glad I didn't unpack.
So
where are you going?
So I do a very brief stop off at home tomorrow and then straight to Dubai. If you want a culture shock, you go from Montana to Dubai in 24 hours. So podcast next week will be however you want to define Dubai. We'll be from there. But as we close out, just want to say, you know, we wandered back into the hotel tonight. And you look up in the skies and then, you know, Montana is known for it. It is the big sky state and the stars that are out there tonight. But I'm also reminded, I had a conversation while I was here, is there are more flat earthers per capita in Montana. So people who believe the earth is flat in Montana than any other part of the country. But it did remind me. While flat earthers are wrong about the shape of the earth, they're not wrong about the shape of the galaxy. I don't know if you know this.
No, I know this. I don't think they're talking about the galaxy, but
yeah. So the earth is round. The galaxy, the Milky Way, the galaxy that we're in is actually flat. It is a flat galaxy. We are thinner than wider. And when we talk about our research of the universe, we are only looking in two directions, up and down, because the galaxy is so wide, we can't see through all the stars and the planets. So on the one hand, I want to say, hey, you guys are dopes because the earth isn't flat. And then on the other, I go, but by the way, the galaxy is.
I'm a flat earther, but I believe the galaxy is round. I'm Ace Callwood. This is Envoy Recorded Radio, and I hope for your sake you don't see us next week.